Jumped off at about the middle of the second chapter, but we'll just begin and touch briefly on the early part of this first chapter. Gather yourselves together, yea, gather together, O nation not desired, my not wanted, the Lord's people, but he didn't want them around. We'll have this in Isaiah tonight, I think, in the first chapter, some of the reasons why. Before the decree bring forth, that is, before the decree of judgment arise, before the day passes the chaff, before the fierce anger of the Lord come upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger come upon you, seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Let's turn for just a moment to Isaiah 26:20. Now this is looking forward to the day of the Lord's anger. I bypassed Isaiah and go back into Psalms. Come, my people, enter thou into thy chambers, and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpast. For behold, the Lord cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood, and shall no more cover her slain. That will be the wholesale slaughter. As you remember, Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 30:7, alas for the day, for it is great, so that there is none like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. And now he says to the meek. Now let us see a little contrast here. All ye meek of the earth, seek meekness. Now notice in the 10th verse, this they shall have for their pride. In the last part of the 11th verse of the next chapter, that rejoice in thy pride, and thou shalt no more be haughty because of my holy mount. And there's a contrast here in those that were proud and in the meek. And now let me say that meekness isn't, let's say two things that it isn't. It isn't cowardice, and it isn't timidity. Some people think a person that's timid is meek. Not necessarily at all. He's a little bit scared. A meek person, you remember Moses? My, was there everybody as, you ever hear of anybody more fiery than Moses? Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. Did you know the scripture says that? Let's turn to Numbers, the 12th chapter. This is at the time that Miriam and Aaron had rebelled against him. And the third verse says, now the man, Moses, was very meek above all the men which were up on the face of the earth. Isn't that a remarkable statement? The word translated meek here means lowly, pious, modest mind, preferring to bear rather than return injuries. That's the way Gesenius gives it. And there was another man that was meek. Could you tell me who that was? Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. Matthew 11:28, I believe. Then Paul said this to the Corinthian church in the 10th chapter of that letter, the second letter. I beseech you by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ. So here is a statement that says to seek meekness. And we might glance at Ezekiel 9:2-5 and see how God protected them in all ways, I guess, since the race began. God has had some people. The numbers shrank awfully low at one time. And I think there were lots of people in the earth in Noah's day. I think there were millions. But there was one family that feared the Lord. And in this section that I just quoted to you, the second verse says, behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lieth toward the north, every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. Now he was going to see Jerusalem destroyed in vision. He himself was in Babylon, but in vision he was in Jerusalem. And one man among them was clothed with linen, and with a writer's inkhorn by his side. And they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And then, notice the latter part of the third verse, he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. My personal opinion is that this was the pre-incarnate Christ. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, go ye after him through the city, and smite, let not your eye spare, neither have ye pity. slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. And you will remember in Revelation, the 9th chapter, that those hellish locusts are given to torment everybody except those that had the seal of God in their foreheads. And in this I find that God, do you realize that God never yet hit the wrong man? He never sent judgment on the wrong man. When the flood came, not one of Noah's family perished. Now, if God allows things to come, well, think for a moment of Lot and his two daughters in Sodom and Gomorrah. They weren't killed, were they? Everybody else was. So it's good to know to whom you belong. I'll just say, praise the name of the Lord. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's wrath. And he had just gotten through giving the most dramatic description of the day of the Lord back in the preceding chapter that there is in the entire Bible. For Gaza shall be forsaken. Now this was one of the cities of the Philistines. Alexander the Great conquered Gaza. He had read, I believe it was Gaza, that he had read about a man that captured a king and tied him behind his chariot and drug him behind his chariot. And when he captured this town, if they hadn't resisted, he wouldn't have done it. But of course, he wasn't justified in doing it, whatever. But he took the man and cut holes back of his, above his ankles, and tied ropes in there, and then drug him around the city behind his chariot. Ashkelon was another one of their great cities. They had five cities. A desolation. They shall drive out Ashdod at noonday, and Ekron shall be rooted up. Woe unto the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nations of Cherethites. One translation says the Cretans for Cherethites. And the Cretans were these people. The Philistines were originally from Egypt. We could turn to scriptures and prove this, but we won't take time for tonight. We're in the second chapter of the book of Zephaniah, and now at the fifth verse. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, the land of the Philistines. I will even destroy thee, that there shall be no more inhabitant. Incidentally, you can still read of Syria, can't you? But do you ever hear of anybody having trouble with the Philistines or the Moabites or the Ammonites? God said they would perish, and perish they have. We don't know. We couldn't place them if we wanted to. The Philistines were Canaanites. That is, they were descendants of Canaan. You remember Ham had four sons, Cush, and we'd probably say Phut. The Hebrew is Phut. Well, in fact, it's Cush and Phut and Mizraim, and suddenly I can't call the other one's name. Mizraim, Phut, Cush, and Canaan. That's it. And I'll tell you how they're translated. Mizraim is translated Egypt, and Cush is translated Ethiopia. And the Canaan and his descendants settled in the land of Palestine, and they gave the two names to the land of Palestine. Palestine is from the word Philistine, and Canaan, of course, is from the word Canaan, another one of Ham's sons. And they stand, I feel, typically for Christendom. The Philistines, one of the meanings of the word is wallower. They stand for religion without a born-again experience. And in all history, it seems as though God has had a remnant, as I started to say a while ago. All through Israel's history, in Paul's time, there was a group of Jews that were Christians. I keep looking down because the light hurts my eyes. And in the days of Elijah, you'll remember that he said, Lord, they have killed your prophets, dug down your altars, and I only am left, and they seek my life. And the Lord said, I have reserved to myself 7,000 men that haven't kissed the lips of Baal and bowed down to him. It was actually a very small number, but there they were, 7,000. Now, you would think that would make a very large church, a very fine, but we're talking about all the people in the nation, 7,000 and several million. And that's the way it has been. That's the way it is today. I went and heard an outstanding minister in Philadelphia once. Had quite a long name, G.B.M. Clouser. He used to write for one of the big Sunday school concerns. And in his estimation, I think he was a little under, but maybe he knew more about it than I do. He judged that in professing Christendom, perhaps 2% was saved. I was on the plane the other day. Well, before I got on the plane, I got to talking to a Catholic sister. I rather had the impression that she may have been saved. And then there was a younger woman came, and I talked to her for quite a while. I make this approach to some of them. I said to the younger Catholic woman, I said, did you ever hear of the charismatic Catholics? Oh, yes, she said, I go to prayer meeting once a week. And I said, I hear they had a meeting over at Notre Dame. Oh, yes, she said, they have one every year over there. said they're praying for the sick and they're getting healed. Well, there will be some Catholics saved. And incidentally, some of the Episcopalian churches have regular healing services now. So there are some saved. I knew one man that joined the Christian Science Organization. I won't call it a church. And he got saved among them, and when he realized he was saved, he left them. That's the only case I ever heard of a Christian Scientist, which is neither Christian nor scientific, being saved. But they seemed to fill that place because, you see, they had much of the land of Palestine, and they were a thorn in the side to Israel from all down through the years. They had the southwest part, down a good part, next to the coast. And so the Lord said in the sixth verse, the seacoast shall be dwellings and cottages for shepherds and folds for flocks. That is, your cities won't amount to anything. And the coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. They shall feed thereupon. In the houses of Ashkelon shall they lie down in the evening, for the Lord their God shall visit them and turn away their captivity. I have heard the reproach of Moab and the revilings of the children of Ammon, whereby they have reproached my people and magnified themselves against their border. Now Moab and Ammon were both illegitimate children, fathered by, well, their mothers were sisters. Their father was the father of the two girls that bore Moab and Ammon. That was Lot. We don't know his children's names. We don't even know his wife's name. I just call her Mrs. Lot. Lot, the Hebrew is Lot. And it is interesting that none of the other people that were related to the Jews, they all seemed to literally hate them so deeply. The Edomites just literally despised them. And Ishmael never showed them any favor. And Moab and Ammon, now Lot was Abraham's nephew. Ishmael was his son. Edom was his grandson. And even Amalek. Now, we do not know whether Amalek was directly descended from Esau or not, that is the nation of Amalek, but even they were just bitter enemies of Israel. Always seems strange that, and yet it shouldn't be strange, that the Lord's people, isn't it a striking thing that so often the Lord's people are despised and hated? And it's because Satan is the god of the world. Now here's what the Lord said. Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be as Sodom, and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah, even the breeding of nettles and salt pits, and a perpetual desolation. The residue of my people shall spoil them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. And as I stated about the Philistines, did you ever meet a Moabite or an Ammonite? You just don't find them around anymore. However, I feel that inasmuch as they were related to Abraham, they too speak in certain respects of those who, well, you remember what Paul said, if you be without chastening, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. And you remember the Lord speaking of Jezebel said, I will kill her children with death. They belong to the church, but they haven't been born again. A sad condition. My, how sad. How near and yet so far. Jesus said to a man one time, thou art not far from the kingdom of God. And you remember the rich young ruler who was so near. And you remember the man that said, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Paul said, I would God that not only you, but all that are here this day, be as I am, almost altogether as I am, except for these chains. And how near people can be and yet go away. I have seen people under deep conviction. You talk to them a time later, and they'd be just defiant. I talked to a man one night. He just seemed on the verge of accepting things, and I went back the next day to see him, and he was like talking. It was like talking to a different man altogether. Well, Moab and Ammon were so near, and yet so far. Lot was a saved man. I don't question that. The book of Peter calls him just Lot, a righteous Lot, and he vexed his soul with the conversation of the wicked. Now, when you come down to brass tacks, you can't really blame Lot in connection with his daughters. They made him drunk. Of course, he shouldn't have got drunk. But he may not have known what he was doing, and so much of the world doesn't look on drunkenness like we do. I told you about the Jew in Denver. He was, you know what a Hasidic Jew is? He's way out. It's like being an out-and-out Pentecostal. He's an out-and-out Jew. And he said to me one time, "We believe that on the day of the Feast of Purim, remember in the book of Esther, we believe in getting so drunk that you can't tell Mordecai from Esther. I mean, Haman from Esther." And I said, "Benjamin, I'd rather see you eat a barrel of pork than to get drunk." He walked out of my house one time when I told him I had a ham in the icebox. That's how Jewish he was. One of my friends fed him some cookies and then told him we made that with hog lard. But he didn't. They have a strange concept. He took me to their synagogue one time, and it was an Orthodox synagogue. And the men just kept coming in and smoking. I spoke to him about it, and he said, "Well, we believe in getting all the pleasure out of the body that we can." Strange way to get it. But back to our lesson. Lot was drunk, and I don't know, Noah was drunk. It is true that after Noah got drunk, the Lord didn't say much more about him. But whether that is the reason or not, I cannot tell. But they didn't seem to look up on it just like we do. "Surely Moab shall be as Sodom, and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah." Do you know where Sodom and Gomorrah are? They say they're under the waters of the Dead Sea, but they can't prove it. They're gone. "Even the breeding of nettles and salt pits. Perpetual desolation. The residue of my people shall possess them. Rather shall spoil them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. This shall they have for their pride, because they have reproached and magnified themselves against the people of the Lord of hosts. The Lord will be terrible unto them, for he will famish all the gods of the earth, and men shall worship him, every one from his place, even all the isles of the heathen." Now notice, we have looked at the Philistines. We've looked at Moab and Ammon. Now we go a ways further away. "Ye Ethiopians also, ye shall be slain by my sword." In Psalm 68:31, it says that Ethiopia shall reach out her hand to God. It doesn't say that they would be annihilated like these other peoples were to be. "He shall stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria." Now don't mix Assyria and Syria. Syria is the first power north of Israel was then. Not now, there was Lebanon there now, but then it was Syria. And then Assyria had Nineveh as its capital. "And I will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like a wilderness, and flocks shall lie down in the midst of her. All the beasts of the nations, both the cormorant and the bittern, shall lodge in the upper lintels of it. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he shall uncover the cedar work. This is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly." Now, we had practically a whole book given to this recently. Nineveh was destroyed about 625 B.C. I'm going to give you just a few statements that I picked up about it. It was 60 miles around the walls. The walls were 100 feet high. They were wide enough for three chariots to run abreast. It had 1,500 towers. It was so destroyed that its location was very hard to find. It never has been fully excavated. One of the reasons is that there's a village on top of it. How completely the Lord can erase things. Did you ever go to a ghost town? I visited a ghost town. There was just one Negro living there. Old E-Town, Elizabeth Town was originally the name of it up in New Mexico. A gold boom town. There were quite a few buildings still there. And that was what Nineveh was to become. Just a place for rats and dogs and these birds that are mentioned. And it sounded about as logical for these prophets to say this as for me to take off down across Kansas City and say, "This town's going to be totally abandoned. The buildings are going to be for the hoot owls and the bats." Wouldn't sound logical, and wouldn't I get laughed at? Well, I'm not just about to do it because the Lord didn't tell me to. Notice, flocks shall lie down in the midst of her, and the beasts of the nations. And it just, some things just aren't logical. One time Elisha was looking at a man, and he began to weep. And the man asked him, what's it all about? He said, "The Lord showed me what you're going to do to the children of Israel." And he said, "Well, what is thy servant? A dog that you do something like this?" He said, "The Lord showed me you're going to be king of Syria." Well, he became king of Syria, and he did those things. And Some things that the Lord speaks of just don't seem to be logical. When Jesus said of Jerusalem, there shall not be left here one stone upon another. Now, he said that to four of his disciples. They later wrote it down. I would suppose that if he'd have said that publicly to Jerusalem, if he did, we have no record of it, people would have said the equivalent of tommy rot, bosh, foolishness. And I will tell you that the Romans were surprised that they ever conquered Jerusalem. You see, they got divided among themselves. They got to fighting among themselves inside. They had so much food stored there. They had such bulwarks. They had such good walls that they didn't think they would conquer it, but they did. And when the Lord decides a thing will go a certain way, it will go that way. And it is interesting to me that in history, there has never been a nation that remained top dog very long. They will for a while, but something will happen. They'll have a strong man. He'll be able to lead them for a while. Then he dies, and things revert, and there will be rebellions. Other forces will take off, and he will be left, or the nation will be left high and dry. The 15th verse says, this is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am, and there is none beside me. And then notice this. How is she become desolate, a place for beasts to lie down in? Everyone that passeth by shall hiss. Like, whew, whew, did you ever see such thing? That's the way people usually speak. And shall wag his head. And they can remember what it was and now what it is. I heard a man speaking to a group of youth one time. He said, youth surely is wonderful, wasn't it? He was speaking from his viewpoint. Youth is wonderful, but he wasn't youth anymore. And so you could say it surely was a great city. It wasn't anymore. And it isn't. Ancient Babylon was just wiped out. Now we come to a woe. Woe to her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city. We go now not to Nineveh, but to Jerusalem. Some of these words are strange translations. The word translated filthy is to rebel. The word translated polluted is to repudiate. The word translated oppressing is to rage, to be violent. And how often this is the way it is. Oppression through taxes. I stopped at a store tonight and bought $3 worth of merchandise. No, I bought more than that. Anyway, the taxes, just sales tax, came to nearly 6 cents on the dollar. It surprised me very much. Then you take out of your dollar your income tax and your state income tax. Then you got your county tax to pay, and then you got your gasoline tax and your car tax. That's oppression.
Social Security,
I've forgotten that. That's a big item, isn't it? It is said that the Roman taxation was so intricate that it has never been fully figured out. There were taxes on a bridge, taxes on the road. If you had a stall where you sold your stuff, there were taxes. And I can understand why the publicans were hated. They were tax collectors. The word procurator, do you know what it means? One who procures. He procured things for the Romans. Well, people will find a way to oppress other people. Notice now the charges in the second verse. She obeyed not the voice. Isn't disobedience a bad thing? I'm not going to do it. I won't do it. She obeyed not the voice. People hate authority. The old man especially hates authority, especially in our day. I guess there has never been a day when we're right on the verge of anarchy, always. Just anymore, you just don't tell people, go do that. My brother was a supervisor for a large company in California, and I heard him telling his son, who was taking such a place, he said, now I'll tell you, you don't tell people to do it, you get them to do it. To disobey or to obey, the Greek word means to hear under. That is, you hear and you submit to it. The next statement is that she received not correction. I'm just as good as you are. Who are you to tell me? She trusted not in the Lord. She drew not near to her God. Four charges. Submission is a great thing to God and to God's established authority. You remember this song, Perfect Submission? You remember this line, Perfect Submission, all is at rest? Is there real rest until there is perfect submission? You know that there isn't, don't you? As long as there is a rebellion, there is discontent, dissatisfaction. This doesn't mean, well, we're told to submit ourselves to the ordinances of men, and we're told to submit ourselves one to another, and The woman is, I remember a man and his wife, and he told me one time, I was telling my wife, the scripture says, for the wife to submit herself to the husband. He said, she quoted me another scripture, said, yea, all of you be subject one to another. Well, submission is a great theme. There have been times in history when God's people were to submit to a woman. You remember Deborah, and you remember Huldah, when one of the greatest kings that Judah ever had sent men to inquire of her about the things of the Lord. So, obedience. Now, there can be an obedience like a mule obeys, like a slave obeys, like a galley slave beaten to the galleys, whipped all the way. But then there is a heart submission that says, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. That's submission. Submission to the will of God. Her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves. They know not the bones till the morrow. Guess they have enough that they don't have to know the bones. How sad. The princes, of course, were the leaders. Now, in the Bible, a prince isn't necessarily a descendant of a king. He's a man that was a leader or prominent in some capacity, like Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Doesn't mean he's the son of a king. Her judges are evening wolves. Those that are set up to execute judgment are there to take advantage. They know not the bones. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. I turned to Jeremiah today, I believe it was, and read a passage about the prophets, but it was so raw, I chose not to read it. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. What an awful statement, and what a thing to have a person on this level supposedly to represent the things of God to you, and yet you find it. I was riding the bus one time, and I got to talking to a man about the Lord, and he belonged to a church, and he told me how much he appreciated a pastor for his honesty. He said, now he tells us, don't do as I do as I say. How would you like to have a pastor like that? But he thought the man was really being honest. Not only are the prophets, first he describes the princes and the judges, and then the religious side of it, the prophets, then her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They've done violence to the law. I have a 5-volume set of the Reformation and the ungodliness that was among the religious leaders. It is said that in Germany alone, in those days, there were 250,000 illegitimate children with priests as their fathers. Father Schenecke told about a girl that disappeared from her community, and a long while later, somebody found her. She was serving as a houseboy for the priest, and they spent a lot of money to get that priest out of the country. Cover up the crime. But notice this, the just Lord is in the midst thereof. Notice the word midst now for just a moment. In the 15th verse, the Lord is in the midst of thee. The 17th verse, the Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. And so here we read, the Lord is in the midst thereof. He will not do iniquity. Now I will say this, God never did wrong in all of his history. He can't do wrong. He will never do wrong. If the Lord did wrong, who would he wrong? Well, himself. He could only harm himself. Everything belongs to him. And there's no point in his cheating anybody, because what does he need? He doesn't have to steal, because everything belongs to him. He doesn't have to lie. Lie is a resource of weakness. You get me in a corner, I might lie my way out. And it's comical. I knew a man once that he ran a little store. And he was always doing things that were bad. And when people do that, they develop a sharpness. Now, I don't know, you know what a gig is that you gig fish with? Sometimes it's a 1 or 2 or a 4-prong fork with gaffs on the points, and you can gig a fish. Well, you've got him. It's just like having him on a hook. Strictly against the law in the state of Oklahoma. This fellow was on what they call Medicine Creek out in southwestern Oklahoma, a clear stream, and he found a pool of water with a lot of catfish in it. He drove his car up there and gigged those fish and put them in his car, and when he drove back, the game warden was in his yard. Well, been me, I'd have been trapped. Not he. He jumped out of his car and rushed over there and said, up here, and told him where the place was. He said, there's a bunch of people gigging. He said, if you go up there right now, you get them. The fellow took off. After a while, he came back and said, well, I found the tracks and everything, but they were gone. By the time he got back, they got the fish out of sight. Now, you see, a person that's in those things, he's quick-witted to do wrong. God doesn't have to do wrong. God is always right. He will not do iniquity. Every morning doth he bring his judgment to light. He faileth not. but the unjust knoweth no shame. That's an interesting statement. First, a people can become so ungodly that you can't embarrass them. One time the Lord said, my people cannot blush, though Ezra, I believe it was, said, I blush to lift up my face unto you. I have cut off the nations, their towers are desolate. I have made their streets waste, that none passeth by. Their cities are destroyed, so that there is no man, that there is none inhabitant. Now he did this, let's say, out there, so his people could see it. And he said, I said, surely thou wilt fear me. Thou wilt receive instruction. In other words, look what I did to Sodom and Gomorrah. Look what I did to Sennacherib. So their dwelling should not be cut off. Howsoever I punished them, but they rose early and corrupted all their doings. Now people as a whole didn't do their drinking early in the morning. These are not drunken, seeing it's but the third hour of the day. But these people rose up early and corrupted their doings. Now another word to the remnant. In this day there is a remnant that believes God. We might say there is the Church of Philadelphia, the Church of Brotherly Love. Philadelphia comes from two words, phileo, meaning I love, and the Greek word for brother is adelphos, and phileo means I love. They were put together and it came out Philadelphia, Brotherly Love, the Church of Brotherly Love. There was no fault found there with that church, and all the scriptures indicate that this is a state that will exist within the professing church at the time when Jesus comes back for the overcomers. And don't ever forget, there will be the overcomers. Years ago, George Griffith, he originated this group of people where Brother Hackett is. And he was in the pulpit, now just think, he said, of handing Christ a hand, and then a head, and then a leg, and telling him to make a bride out of it. That was what he meant by the ranks. He said that a donkey with its brains knocked out made a good ranks preacher. Well, maybe he's right, maybe that's what's wrong with me, but I still preach ranks. So there is a remnant. There will be a company of overcomers at the end of the age, and we feel that they are the ones that will be translated as the full overcomers, those that are ready, fully ready, when Jesus comes. Remember the five foolish virgins as an illustration. Don't misunderstand me to say the wise virgins are over with the Philadelphia church. They're not. I'm just using an illustration. Or think of Lot and the difference in Lot and Abraham and the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham wasn't mixed up in it at all. He was up yonder on the mountains. Lot was in it and had to be delivered, and then Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation. Remember the 14th chapter of Zechariah, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem. Then remember how the Lord uses the evil spirits in Revelation 16 to gather the nations together. An unclean spirit, like that goes out of the mouth of the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, that gathers the nations together. And here's why the Lord said he gathers them together. To pour upon them mine indignation, even my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. Just wait around and it will come. Jealous for his people, jealous for his glory and for his name. And you think for a moment, everything that there is belongs to God. I've never forgotten what Brother Huff said to a band one time. He told me, he said this, he was working at a place out at one of the plants here in town, and he started to eat dinner, he bowed his head and offered thanks. And he said, some man came over and mentioned it to him. He said, yes, he said, any old hog can eat acorns all day without ever lifting its eyes to the tree that gave it the acorns. Now that's the way the world is. They're eating the acorns, but they don't even notice the tree that gave the acorns. And God owns the earth. It belongs to him. It's been mistreated. God owns the race. They mistreat each other, destroy each other. And he will come forth against those nations. For then will I turn to the people a pure language, that they may call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent. I wonder if this won't be a Hebrew teacher. We were taking Hebrew one time, and he believes that the first language, the original language, was Hebrew. And here was one of the arguments that he gave. Adam said of his wife, she is woman because she was taken out of man. Now what he said is, she is Isha because she was taken out of Ish. And he said Hebrew is the only language where those two words will fit together. And he had some pretty good arguments. There are quite a few scholars that believe the first language was Hebrew. And it may go back to that. You remember when languages changed? The 11th chapter of the book of Genesis, when people decided to build the Tower of Babel, and they did get it well underway. And the Lord came down and confounded their languages. It would be something. Your brother Eggers and I were here talking, and suddenly I couldn't understand him, and couldn't understand me. I'd think he had gone crazy, and he'd think I had. And it was a judgment from God on them to stop their building. And my, how many languages there are. The Bible has been put in 11 or 1,200 different languages. And there are dead languages. In John Sherrill's book on They Speak With Tongues, he told about a young Episcopalian minister that got filled with the Spirit. And he was in a restaurant. And there's a young woman. Somehow they got together at a table. And he asked her if he could pray for her. And he started praying and speaking in tongues. And the woman turned pale and said, "Where did you learn it?" Or did I learn what? Well, you were speaking in the very ancient language of Egypt. Her father was an Egyptologist, and she recognized the language. Rather interesting, isn't it? Now, the reason the Lord picked up that language that had been dead for centuries was to be a testimony to that young woman. And so they will serve him with a pure language. I'm glad the Jews are restoring Hebrew to their nation. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, even the daughter of my dispersed, shall bring mine offering. In that day shalt thou not be ashamed for all thy doings, wherein thou hast transgressed against me. For then I will take away out of the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride, and thou shalt do no more be haughty because of my holy mountain. Isn't pride a strange thing? And isn't it a stinking thing? Why should the spirit of mortal be proud? I must get that poem out, and it goes on to say there's just such a short step to the shroud. And we look at people. I often think of this. Now, people will be proud. There was a woman in our town that was too poor to hire legal authority, and she needed it. She asked me if I would take her and her children to Kansas City. There was a place there that provided it for free, and I did. And on the way home, she got to bragging on her son. You know what she said? "They have made him the head dishwasher and give him a week's vacation." Now, you and I smile at that. But on a certain level of life, well, that was quite an accomplishment, I guess. And there is pride. The Lord said, "I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and a poor people." Do you believe there can be holy affliction? Believe there can be holy sufferings? I do. Notice what is said about them. They shall trust in the name of the Lord. "To this man will I look, even to him that is of a meek and a quiet spirit, and trembleth at my word," the Lord said through the prophet. "The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid." That's a remarkable statement, isn't it? How would you like to be in a society where they didn't do iniquity, that carries the thought of lawlessness, they didn't speak lies, and you wouldn't find a deceitful tongue? Business and life is built on deceit. I was in a car lot one time with my son. He wanted to buy a car. And the fellow deliberately led me to believe a lie about the car, and I discovered it. And I said, "You deliberately led me to believe thus and so." He didn't deny it. And we just turned around and walked out of the lot. Brother Webb in our meeting is a mechanic. He rebuilds cars. And he said he got hold of a real old car, and put in brand new ball joints and completely revamped the front end and took it to a garage in Leavenworth so the fellow could line up the front end. And the fellow looked at it and he said, "You got to have new ball joints and everything new." He said, "Well, that surely is strange." He said, "I put those in there at home and drove it over here 11 miles. And I think it's very strange that they'd wear out in that thing that distance." The fellow said, "Well, they sold you the wrong kind." Now, there was a mouth full of lies and deceit. And in this field, my daughter came home scared one time and said she had had her car in a place to have it serviced, and the fellow said he wouldn't drive that car across town. And I took it to a friend of mine. He put it up on the hoist, and he said, "I wish my car were just in as good a condition as that one is." Sister Monroe came to a youth camp one time, and the fellow told her he was surprised that anybody would go across the country with the kind of tires she had on. She had better tires than I had. This is just a few illustrations. I have had a good friend in Tulsa as a father of two of my two sons-in-law. He said to me, "Don't you leave your car in any filling station in Tulsa. Don't leave it alone." He said, "They're ruining tires and ruining batteries." He said, "We watched a man through binoculars, the sheriff, the prosecuting attorney, and himself, ruining a tire and a battery, but he said you couldn't prosecute him on that evidence because it was through glasses." Well, this is deceit. They're shrewd and cunning. But in this time, there will be no deceitful tongue found in their mouth. Now to this group of people, he says, "Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Jerusalem." Sounds like he's going to give Isaiah or Zechariah 9. "Be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem." It's interesting how so often our rejoicing is restrained. We're afraid to rejoice too loud. It might change suddenly and we'd be sorry we were so happy. But he tells them to rejoice without restraint. "The Lord hath taken away thy judgments. He hath cast out thine enemy. The King of Israel, even the Lord, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil any more." I just say, Lord, haste today. Won't it be good? Well, we're going to have to knock off for a few minutes. "Thou shalt not see evil any more." Evil here means evil, no doubt, in the sense of that which is bad, not necessarily moral bad, but just morally bad, but calamitous. "In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, Fear not, fear thou not, and to Zion, Let not thine hands be slack." When the Lord tells us about situations not to be afraid, well, he will have things in hand and keep them in hand. "Now again, the Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty." Several years ago, I received a letter from dear old Brother Sherman. He died in 1941. And he opened it with this: "Dear Brother Franklin, the Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing." Did it ever occur to you that the Lord sings? You remember before they left the room of the Passover, when they had sung a hymn, they went out. And did you ever notice this in Romans? I believe it's the 15th chapter, where he said he would sing, that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy. "For this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing unto thy name." And then in Hebrews 2, there's a similar statement, a little different of course. "In the midst of the church," we read in the 12th verse, "will I sing praise unto thee." I wonder, notice it says, "Behold, I and the children which God hath given me." I wonder when he will get them all together, if it won't be a time of singing. But I like that 17th verse especially, if what it says the Lord will do. He's in the midst of thee. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. That's quite a statement, isn't it? Rest in his love. Just satisfied and happy. He will joy over thee with singing. Brother Eggers, that'll be a good sermon text for you Sunday morning. Let's turn for just a moment to Isaiah 62:5 and notice how it fits in here. That says, "For as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee, and as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee." Quite a good statement, isn't it? That's Isaiah 62:5, if you were wondering. While we're so near, we look at Isaiah 65:19, which reads like this: "I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying." That's good, isn't it? Now here we're reading of the earthly people, but the New Testament gives us the heavenly people. "I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly, who are of thee to whom the reproach of it was a burden. Behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict thee. I will save her that halteth, and gather her that was driven out. I will get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame." It is interesting that the Jews are shamed in practically every part of the world. There was a group of people came to Palestine, and for generations they had to live among the Mohammedans. And the Mohammedans made them live in basement houses because it couldn't be that a Jew would ever look down on a Mohammedan. If he lived up there in a two-story house, he'd have to look down on a Mohammedan. That couldn't be. They had to live in basement houses all through the years. I imagine they feel that deeply. I have known some fine colored people in my time, but how often they have been humiliated and embarrassed, and will still be so, where they have been put to shame. "At that time will I bring you again, even the time that I gather you, For I will make you a name and a praise among all people. Now there are times when things are valued. Twice in my life I've had to say this to a woman. I have one thing to offer, and that's the things of God. I don't have anything else. Now if people don't value me for my knowledge of the Word of God, I don't have any value in the other field. I can't overhaul a car. I can't build a house. I can't lay brick. I can't cook a good meal. I can fry potatoes and an egg and make toast. But so the Jew, I suppose at this time, will be valued, well, because the Lord is with him. And that's how he will have a name. At that time will I bring you again, even the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith the Lord. That is the end of this precious little prophet as he tells about the restoration of Israel. I'm glad he wrote.